From KMUW Studios and part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Books and Whatnot. I'm Suzanne Perez, KMUW's resident book reviewer.
And I'm Beth Golay, host of KMUW's Marginalia Podcast. This episode was recorded on May 9th, 2025. Any references to new or forthcoming and the like are relative.
Hey there.
It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. There's been a lot going on, but it is always great to get back in the studio with you to talk books. I've had a pretty good reading spring. How about yourself?
I thought I had. I felt like I was just reading all of the time.
Uh-huh. We were.
But when I went back to look at like the interviews I'd done to figure out what books I wanted to talk about, I feel like I just haven't read that much.
You have, though.
Maybe.
But you've had, like, once again, Beth is getting another degree, and, you know, that means a lot of school work, which means a lot of school reading. But, you know, I was thinking, I've been doing a lot of different kinds of reading, and it's really been fulfilling for me this spring. For instance, can I tell you about, this is before we get into current reads or anything.
I love it.
I want to go ahead and tell people about this because they can still catch up on it. It's something called Dracula Daily. Have you ever read Dracula by Bram? Is it Bram Stoker or Bram Stoker?
I think I always thought it was
Bram.
Bram.
Yeah. Anyway, Dracula was written, you know, in the late 1800s by Bram Stoker. I read it and loved it in college when I took my 19th century British literature class. I haven't read it since. Until I heard about this thing called DraculaDaily.com. It's a Substack and it's also an email. It's absolutely free. You go to DraculaDaily.com and you sign up and it gives you Dracula the novel. It's an epistolary novel and it gives it to you as it goes with the dates of the entries.
Hmm.
And it started on May 3rd. So we're going to get this episode out in May sometime.
Yes.
So there's still time to go back and sort of catch up. And it goes through just after Halloween, I believe. So I'm going to be reading Dracula again in this very interesting way, because I just realized with my last entry that it doesn't go in order of the book. The dates that you get the entries are not necessarily the order they are in the book, because it starts with Jonathan Harker's journal and then it moves to some letters between him and his wife. It's just so cool because, you know, the last entry was like, you know, May 5th or whatever. And then the next entry in Dracula Daily is a letter from his wife, but that happens in the book after a couple of other entries of his journal.
Okay, so for those of us who have never read Dracula, mm-hmm. would you recommend reading it in this manner or reading it as it's presented in the book?
Well, I guess you should always opt for at least the first read through to be the way the author presents it.
So this might be a fun reread for those who have.
Good point.
Also, is it scary? I've never read Dracula.
It's, you know, I mean, obviously it's about vampires, and it's a little bit scary, but it's really just suspenseful and very cool, and the writing is incredible. It's atmospheric. You know, it's one, okay. You know, did you think Rebecca was scary, but Daphne du Maurier?
Did I tell you about my experience with Rebecca?
I don't think I had. I don't think so. The way you're looking, the way your face looks, I don't think so. I don't think I knew.
I started reading / listening because I found a really fantastic old copy. And then I found an audiobook version of it. But it's when our public library, we weren't using Libby, we were using that RB Digital or something like that.
Yes, I remember RB Digital.
And oh my gosh, this narrator was so fantastic. And it was, what is the name of the manor? Is it Mendeley?
Mendeley. Yes.
Mendeley.
Yes.
And anyway, I did not finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And Libby does not have that version.
Brutal.
I'm a little bummed.
You need some kind of free credit to go and find that audio and finish it.
If you are listening somewhere outside of Wichita and you have RB Digital and you have access to Rebecca, just tell me who the narrator is so I can figure out exactly what I'm looking
so
for.
So you just need to figure out what the name of the narrator so you can get the right copy.
Yes.
Oh, man, that is brutal. Anytime you have to turn something in before you're done
or
something like that happens, I'm sorry that happened to you.
I am too.
All that to say, Dracula and Rebecca are more gothic suspense atmosphere than actual, like,
more
oh, my
like
God, I
fall
can't
of,
go to
fall
sleep.
Fall of the House of Usher.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, more Edgar Allan Poe than Stephen King.
Okay. Well, I might attempt Dracula then, but probably not in this manner because,
yeah.
like I said, I've not read it, and I think I want to read it in the way it's presented.
Yeah, kind of like that whole Chronicles of Narnia thing where it's like, do you read them the way they – in the order they were published or in the order – or the Star Wars movies, you
well,
know?
Well, yes, but C.S. Lewis did say he wanted – it was it The Magician's Nephew or something like that. He, even though it was written after, he wanted that one to be read first.
Which is why he made it the first in the series.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, we can get into the particulars, but you're right. I think that if it's your first read through, definitely read Dracula, save it for October.
Okay.
And then maybe sign up for Dracula Daily next year. But this, for me, is going to be a great way. And I honestly did not realize it wasn't in order
mm-hmm.
until this last entry that I read. And I was like, wait a second, because I've been having my bookmark in the book as I've gone along so I can, you know, check off my progress. And I was like, wait a second, there's some stuff between here. Oh, I get it now. So it's going to be interesting to read it in that way.
But yeah.
Anyway, it's a slow and steady read. And then I've been reading, you know, like more nonfiction. I've picked up some really interesting books, which we will get to a little bit later.
Did you see that book club in California that finally finished the book they were reading for like 20 years?
Oh, no.
Let me find it. So this book club... they spent 28 years reading Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, my God. 28 years.
28 years. And at first, they were reading 2 pages a month, but then eventually just slowed down to one.
And were they still getting together to drink? I'm going to guess yes.
I don't know.
Oh, wow. That gives a whole new meaning to slow and steady read. My gosh. A page a month.
A page a month.
Did they discuss the page? There's so many questions here.
I think they had to have because it's notoriously difficult. I've never read Finnegan's Wake.
It sounds difficult. Isn't it a stream of consciousness?
It's James Joyce, so probably.
Yeah.
And they met monthly to read a page and discuss it.
We should tell Susan that maybe that's the way she needs to finish Infinite Jest.
I think I sent this to her, and she said, reminds me of Infinite Jest. Yeah.
It's, you know, the best laid plans and all that, you know, but there's nothing wrong with going slow with a book. And, you know, they just proved it. They finished, though.
Yeah.
Wow.
They started in 1995, but they just finished it.
They probably lost a few members along the way.
That's what I'm wondering. The Washington Post even did an article about it. Since you got to cut in and talk about Dracula, I'm going to cut in.
It's called... fascinating what's happening with my life, Beth.
Okay. Here's a fascinating what's happening with my life
Great.
Segment.
Okay.
No, I just want to say thank you to Stephen Johnson of Newton, because Stephen sent us an article to read from, is it called Psych or Psyche?
I bet it's Psyche. Otherwise, it'd be like Psych.
Anyway, from this publication, and it's on the power of bibliotherapy. And I absolutely loved it because I do feel that bibliotherapy is something that I would love to do. Right now, I read because I have to, but I really would love to read to get myself out of burnout.
Well, so when you say you would love to do bibliotherapy, you mean as a recipient, not as as the practitioner.
I would love to...
Because I wouldn't mind being a practitioner of bibliotherapy.
Okay, well, why don't you talk? You be my practitioner.
You could be my client. You could... How does that make you feel, Beth? So what I'm hearing is you would like to read books that fit your mood.
I don't want to feel like I want to throw a book across the room, that kind of therapy.
That would be bad.
I want to, yeah, it's an escape. And right now it's a job.
It's, yeah, that is one of the curses of our job. There's a lot of good about doing book stuff for a living. But yeah, with the weekly reviews, I have to always be reading current mm-hmm. stuff. I don't have the opportunity to just pick something off the shelf or just go with my mood altogether. But I like the idea. We will also include this link in the show notes for you to read the same story that Stephen Johnson sent to us, which, yes, absolutely. Thank you, Stephen, for writing and thinking of us. It's therapy, but with books, it's exactly the way the name, what you would assume with the name. But I love the idea of this like prescription pad where you could say, take one chapter nightly with wine.
One page monthly with wine.
Yes. But I could think of a lot of therapeutic books. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're feeling burned out, what do you read? When you're feeling like you're struggling with a relationship, or you want some more self-confidence or whatever. I can think of a lot of different situations.
Yeah, and I think the article had some examples, like George Eliot read something when she was getting over the death of her husband. I think they had a listing or an example of that. There were many, many examples in this article. And I also want to go back and kind of clarify something that I said, where I was talking about how this is a job. I have read a lot of fantastic books. But it's so funny, the minute I schedule the interview, it does become a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's just par for the course, I guess.
So I don't want to complain. Like, we're not poor me.
Yeah, we're not griping. We're not griping about it by any means. We do this by choice. But yeah, it does limit your, what you can read. One of these days, Beth, you and I are going to be retired and just laying back reading whatever the heck we please. But until then, here we are.
And I have some good books that I want to talk about.
So do I. But one quick last note about bibliotherapy. And I'm thinking, what about all those grief books that we've been talking about lately? I'm thinking of Memorial Days from Geraldine Brooks and, Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking. Mm-hmm. Think about, when I was reading those, one of the things that was top of mind was this would be so comforting to someone going through that experience, or someone in your life is going through that experience and you want to, empathize mm-hmm. more deeply. I think that books are so powerful in so many ways, but certainly I have felt the power of bibliotherapy in the past.
I remember, this is probably more than 20 years ago, a friend of mine was diagnosed with breast cancer, and so I gave her a book to read. And she called me and she said, thank you so much for that book. She said, not to slam on everybody else who gave me all these feel-good, pick-me-up, therapeutic-type books. I gave her A Girl Named Zippy. And she laughed and laughed and laughed. And she said that was the therapy she needed, was to laugh.
Escapism. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that there is, there's no particular certification to become a bibliotherapist. It's all very unofficial these days anyway. I mean, some of them are like social workers or psychologists who sort of incorporate books into their practice. But there is a new book out just recently called Bibliotherapy in the Bronx. It's by Emily Rumble. And I heard about it on a podcast recently where they interviewed, I believe it was Book Riot, they interviewed the author sort of about her practice. So it is definitely something that it's sort of up and coming and going to become more prevalent, I think. Hmm. So, yeah, but that could be an interesting, she's just sort of in Bibliotherapy in the Bronx, the author sort of talks about the healing power of literature and how, her personal and professional experiences with it. So that might be one to check out. Okay. I haven't read it, but
very good.
But thank you, Stephen, for sending that email. And we are always open to interesting stories and links and recommendations and anything you want to send us. Where do people send that, Beth?
Send it to podcasts@kmuw.org.
Yeah. Great. So, all right, let's talk about our current reads or our recent reads. What have you got?
Oh, well, the first one I want to talk about is The Antidote by Karen Russell. I read this one a while ago, but we haven't recorded for a minute, so I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about it. Karen Russell was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for Swamplandia. And curiously, this was in 2012 when there were three finalists named, but no award was given. Mm. And we might want to talk about that later because the Pulitzers were just announced.
Pulitzer tea to spill.
Yeah. So she has three published collections of short stories and a novella, and The Antidote is her second novel. It's an American epic set in the 1930s, immediately following the Black Sunday dust storm. It's set in the land of Uz, Nebraska, and it has a little bit of everything. Basketball, prairie witches who collect memories, a magical camera, a scarecrow, so much more. It's not Oz-related.
Instead,
the land of Uz is from the Book of Job. That's where she drew inspiration. On her website, it says that this novel is above all a reckoning with a nation's forgetting, enacting the settler amnesia and willful omissions passed down from generation to generation, and unearthing not only horrors, but shimmering possibilities. Mm-hmm. So this book was magical to me. I find her writing impeccable, and her command of the language is just awe-inspiring. And I just really loved it a lot. And I know you read it too.
I did. It was our KMUW Literary Feast selection for April. And I too thought it was magical. Now, I will say Dust Bowl, anything Dust Bowl is a catnip trope for me. I love Dust Bowl novels. And this is one of the best I've read. And I say this every time. It did make me want to go back and read her backlist, mm-hmm. Swamplandia and the short stories that she's written, because her writing, like you said, is so fantastic. But you know what else is her reporting, her research? Mm. You know, she goes into the Resettlement Association documentary project, and she, you know, had researched it down to know who was kind of in charge of that and punching holes in the negatives. There was also really cool photos included in the book. It's also mm-hmm. in the digital copy of the book. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, likewise. I, too, want to go back and read her backlist. Yeah, that was The Antidote by Karen Russell.
All right, I am bringing for my first book for you, Sunrise on the Reaping by Suzanne Collins. Have you read The Hunger Games trilogy, Beth?
No.
I rarely read a series, I will say, but I read and adored that series back in the day. I first read The Hunger Games only because I was doing a story about the campus read, the first time Kansas universities started having like a freshman read, mm-hmm. like everybody coming in reads the same book, and then we'll talk about it when you all get to campus. K-State started that with The Hunger Games.
Oh, wow.
The first Hunger Games novel. And I was so intrigued reporting that story that I ended up reading the novel, and then, of course, I went on and read all three. Sunrise on the Reaping just came out this spring, and it is a Hunger Games prequel. It's been a minute since I read the Hunger Games trilogy, and I will say, after the trilogy, there was a different prequel called mm-hmm. The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes,
right.
which had such mixed reviews that I kind of avoided it. I just heard from a lot of readers whose opinions I value that they just did not like it or did not finish it, so I never read it. This one, though, tells the backstory of Haymitch Abernathy, who is the mentor for Katniss and Peeta when they go into the arena for the first Hunger Games. And so what's interesting to me, Beth, is you know going into this novel that Haymitch survives, mm-hmm. and yet it's still so suspenseful. This book was not a disappointment in any way. She recaptured the magic of that first Hunger Games book and then also Catching Fire and Mockingjay. We go back into the arena. We have all of the drama of this, kids fight to the death, mm-hmm. dystopian nightmare. We have the politics, and we meet Haymitch on the day of his reaping when he is chosen to be a tribute from his district to the Hunger Games. Had me hooked from the beginning. Propulsive, all of the things that you are used to with The Hunger Games. So high, high marks for Sunrise on the Reaping by Suzanne Collins. So glad to say that.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so my next one is titled The Pretender, and the author is Joe Harkin.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear about this one.
Yeah, so when Joe Harkin was in the middle of writing like a science fiction novel, she took a procrastination break to read a book about kings and queens.
Oh, can we do that sometime? Yeah. Just take a procrastination break?
Maybe that was her bibliotherapy. So that's when she came across the name Lambert Simnel in the footnotes of British history. He was a known pretender to Henry VII's throne. Now, in this case, the pretender claimed to be Edward, the 17th Earl of Warwick. And the claim was that his father, George, the Duke of Clarence, and brother to Richard III, swapped his son for like a peasant child to protect his son's life until he could ascend to the throne. So Lambert Simnel was real. he's acknowledged and written about in history. Yes. So in the novel The Pretender, Harkin elevates Simnel from the footnotes to an imagined history, filling in with fiction what written history might have left out.
That's the best kind of historical fiction.
So, you know, we meet this main character, whatever his name is, as a child in a village when he is retrieved to return to the throne, and we follow him through the next several years while they educate him and keep him hidden. And it just goes through, like, the different wars, and I'm not going to say anything more because I don't want to spoil this novel. Mm-hmm. But we follow him and through everything that Harkin imagines happened to him. One thing I really loved was how Harkin brought in language of the day, you know, like resurrecting words that have become obsolete. And I really don't read a lot. I don't typically read a lot of historical fiction, especially from this time frame. But it was a nice little escape for me.
So was it written in the language of the day, or was it more approachable than that?
It was approachable. Mm-hmm. But, like, even the spellings of England might have been, you know, she would have chosen the spellings from that time
like
period.
Like with Y's or something.
And I won't include this because we would receive all sorts of FCC fines, but they use the F word every day.
Wow.
Like, it was just part of their vernacular, but it was more of, like, me saying, shoot, or something like that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I think we could say that, because you said F word.
Yeah, I'll leave that in there.
That's interesting.
And, yeah, when I spoke with her, she was talking about just how common that word was. Well, and it wasn't, you know, considered
obscenity.
Yeah, it wasn't considered an obscenity like we would today.
And is that a cultural thing with Britain versus the United States? Because there are some other words I can think of that Brits say quite commonly that we do not say.
I can't speak to those words. I'm not sure.
I wonder. That's interesting. So you can't be offended by the an occasional F-bomb if you're going to read this.
No.
Or it's just part of the regular parlance, and it just sort of becomes normal.
Look at you, parlance.
Ooh, parlance, like Leslie Jones. It's part of her normal parlance.
Right.
And another book I also enjoyed, you can't be offended by more than the occasional F-bomb in that memoir.
Right.
But that sounds great. Yeah.
Okay. The Pretender by Jo Harkin.
And as always, Beth had fantastic author interviews with a lot of the books she's bringing today. So we will include those in the show notes as well.
Let me look here. Talk to all of them.
I know. Yeah. See, you read a lot. Okay, so my first book that I brought was a follow-up that I really, really loved. And now I'm going to talk about a follow-up that I was super excited for, and I'm sorry to say just did not hit the mark for me.
I'm wondering which one it's going to be, because you've had two of those.
Yeah, I'm not bringing that other one, but maybe next month. So you know, Beth, how much I loved a novel called Mary Jane by Jessica Anya Blau. A stunning novel about a girl coming of age in the 70s and all of these, you know, exciting, weird things happen. I have recommended it so many times. So I was very, very thrilled to hear that Jessica Anya Blau had another novel coming out. And this one is called Shop Girls. Just came out this month. It is set in the 1980s. And it follows a young woman named Zippy. So funny that you had mentioned Zippy. A young woman named Zippy who works at a high-end department store in San Francisco called iMagnon. There is plenty to like about this novel, but on the whole, I don't know if it was my expectations. That could very well be that my expectations were just so high that nothing could compare to, you know, her first novel for me. But this one just kind of fell short. It tells the story of Zippy, and she's a sales girl on the floor. It's the 80s. There's some really great scenes of her interacting with customers. But on the whole, the novel just kind of wanders. There's a lot of silliness where she is playing with paper dolls with her colleagues in the department store. And there's some kind of interesting characters, but have you ever had a reading experience where you're just kind of like, where is this going? And I kept reading because I wasn't going to give it up. But then it also tried to weave in some very serious topics in the 80s, including the AIDS epidemic.
Hmm.
It had a twist at the end that was a little out there and unbelievable. I'm so sorry to say I came away from this novel just like, oh no, it just did not live up to my expectations. And I know we just have to be honest about our reading experiences because those sorts of things happen. And it could just be me. This novel could be just wonderful for the next reader. What I would recommend is if you haven't read Mary Jane, read Mary Jane. That is a fabulous summer novel as well. But I needed to say that Shop Girls just fell a little short for me. So that was Shop Girls by Jessica Anya Blau.
Will you try her next one?
I will. You know what? I will. Because, I was talking to a friend in our short story group who's a publicist, actually. And he said, I wonder, she had so much success with that first novel. And I wonder if, there's sometimes authors have contracts where they, maybe their agent or whatever said, oh, what were you working on? Do you have anything else in the works? Maybe you were working on something before this, and let's sort of beef that up a little and get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And, so too often I think writers just sort of get into that grind of just having to produce. And so many times the sophomore novel doesn't live up to that debut.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah.
If they just kind of rushed to publication to ride the success of Mary Jane.
I
don't know.
Yeah, I wonder too. But anyway, I just, I feel like I've had some friends tell me before, you like every book. You rave about every book you read. And it's like, nah, not always. And I don't like to, to be negative, but I had recommended that book, and I was so excited about this one. I know a lot of other fans of hers are excited about this one. I just had to give my honest opinion.
Yeah.
So that is Shop Girls by Jessica Anya Blau.
I rarely will bag on
sure.
a book. And
yeah.
I do remember the first negative review I ever wrote when I was at Watermark. I'll tell you about it later.
You're not going to rag on it now either. She's so discreet. This is how she gets all the author interviews that she does. They can't look back and say, oh, man, you ragged on her last novel. You're not talking to Jessica.
Honestly, though, I might even try to go back and read this book again.
Oh, yeah.
In my review, I said it was unreadable. There
oh,
was
wow.
There was no diction.
That is harsh.
I couldn't understand it.
Oh, wow. Was it like, like no punctuation?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
It was
diction with no punctuation.
Oh, I do hate that.
But maybe I could handle it now.
That was
25 years ago.
That is a great point, Beth, because so often when we don't like something, in the same way that we can like something at one point and reread it and go, what was I thinking? I think the opposite is also true. I think that so much of what we take from our reading experience goes to the mood we're in,
mm-hmm.
the age we are. I have a hard time, as you know, with angsty millennials in my novels. Sally Rooney, bless her heart, I love some of her books, but some of them drive me up the wall. And that's because I am past that age and it's more annoying to me. So this book could be just the right book for someone else, but not this reader.
Okay.
Yeah.
Heather McGowan, I'm going to give schooling another try.
Now I want to read it.
Well, listen to the description. Schooling is a portrait of a 13-year-old Katrine Evans who, following her mother's death, is uprooted from her home in America to an English boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
There she encounters unruly classmates and the sympathetic teacher, Mr. Gilbert, who offers Katrine the friendship she so desperately wants, a friendship that gradually takes on sinister and obsessive overtones.
Bum, bum, bum. I would read that.
Yeah, I need to go back.
Yeah, I would totally read
and
that.
And I'll issue a public apology.
How many years later? Sorry.
I know. I feel bad.
Feel bad. We have to be. We can't just be Pollyannas about this thing, Beth. We can't just bring stuff we love. Because people get into reading ruts. They'll read a bad book and think, well, everyone else liked that and I didn't. What's wrong with me?
Right.
But I think that, I think we have to just give the full picture.
And it has such a beautiful cover. I am going to go back
and
read it.
Okay, yeah, now I'm intrigued.
Okay, so my next one is called The Imagined Life by Andrew Porter. This book follows Stephen, a 50-year-old man whose marriage is on the rocks, and he's trying to uncover the truth behind what happened to his father, who disappeared when Stephen was just 12 years old. Mm. It has a dual timeline between Stephen searching today and 1980s California and what was happening at home before his father disappeared. The book explores issues like homosexuality and mental health, which, you know, in the 80s weren't openly discussed. And Porter does a really nice job of, you know, helping the reader to assimilate into time and place. I had another Helen Russo moment, if you remember that character from Claire Lombardo's Same As It Ever Was. Mm-hmm. But this time, Stephen went to visit his uncle and aunt in Ojai, California, and I just want to move in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Into the house.
Yeah.
Is it a Nancy Myers scene?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this one. It was a good book, The Imagined Life by Andrew Porter.
Okay. Beth, you remember my new favorite genre, right?
WTF?
That is correct. WTF. So people know this about me now, and I get a text from a friend with the cover of this book I am holding up, a book called Two-Step Devil by Jamie Quatro. I get this text, and my friend says, "You like quirky, yes?" And I said, "Yeah, I like quirky. I like WTF." And the cover, my friends, has a goat with devil horns on it.
Like hand-drawn.
Yes,
the goat is a nice pencil rendering, but the horns.
It just looks, it looks weird.
Looks like it's been defaced.
It looks weird. Yeah, the horns are red. It looks, kind of graffiti-like. Anyway, I was like, sign me up. And it was at the library. All the better. Oh, my goodness. I loved this book. It is so weird. Let me try and explain it to you people. It takes place in 2014 in Lookout Mountain, Alabama. I should say that Jamie Quatro, the author, is from Chattanooga. Or she lives with her family in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So right around that Appalachian sort of area. Lookout Mountain, Alabama, the first we meet a man who goes by the Prophet. He's 70. He has these visions, and he's living in squalor in this kind of ramshackle cabin in Alabama that he built himself around a tree. Every now and then he has visions, and he makes them into art. He has a son named Zeke, who he raises after his wife dies. And I'm not giving too much away here, but we hear the story from the Prophet's point of view. We hear about his visions. He has a plan to get, he needs to get these visions to the President of the United States in D.C. Early in the novel, he goes into town to try and collect some supplies from the local scrapyard to make another one of his weird folk art masterpieces. He's making like an Ezekiel's wheel sort of thing. It reminds me, you know that artist that has those weird sculptures? I'm thinking of the Garden of Eden in Lucas, Kansas, but also Mullenville, Kansas.
Yeah.
There's those weird, creepy sculptures on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. This is what this reminds me of. I was thinking of that guy the whole time. And may he rest in peace, because he's no longer with us, that Kansas artist. M.T. Liggett, that's his
Liggett.
Name.
Yep, mm-hmm. I just looked it up.
Yeah, so this is sort of an Appalachian M.T. Liggett. Anyway, he's at the scrapyard, and he sees this young woman essentially in a very obvious situation where she is being trafficked. This book gets dark, let me tell you. Her wrists are bound with zip ties. She's being drugged. But it's all very sort of covert in the bathroom of this gas station. And he sees it, and then he makes the decision that he's going to be the one to save this girl. And so anyway, the novel develops from there, and it does not go where you think it's going to go.
Hmm.
It's incredibly dark and atmospheric, but also just brilliant. Her writing is sparse and surprising. I downed this novel in 2 days, really, I mean, just in two sittings. It's not all that long. It's only, let's see, I've got it here. It's less than 300 pages. But you get so many different perspectives about what's going on, and the end is so astonishing. It really speaks to just a lot of modern issues, some really, really tough topics. Like I said, it's very dark. There's a lot of triggers here. We've got, you know, he's a very sick man in a lot of ways. He's both physically and mentally ill. We've got, you know, sex trafficking. We've got, you know, a lot of different hard topics in this, but it deals with faith and loyalty and who's really good and who's really evil. And I can't say enough good things about this novel. It's not going to be for everyone, mm-hmm. in the same way that Big Swiss or Monstrillo, any of those other WTF books that I have brought to the show, are not going to be for everyone. But Two Step Devil by Jamie Quatro, wow, what a reading experience that was. I just adored it. So good. Thank you to my friend Carrie for telling me about this novel. And I really, really loved it.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay, the last book I'm going to talk about is called The Red House by Mary Morris. This novel features a 40-something woman named Laura who is trying to discover what happened to her mother who disappeared when she was 12 years old.
Wait, this is a theme.
Sound familiar?
So they were all Disney movies.
Well, with this one,
there's no moms, there's lots of orphans, there's people being hidden.
And with this one, we follow Laura to Italy, where she tries to find clues about her mother's disappearance because her mother left behind a series of paintings of a red house that hinted at some unknown part of her past. So in Italy, Laura discovers that the Red House was really an internment camp for Italian Jews during World War II. And so while this book is fiction, the Red House really exists. Morris, who also writes a lot about travel, she teaches at Sarah Lawrence, and she also is a travel writer. She told me that she was in an Italian village one day and she saw a plaque nailed to a tree that happened to be written in two languages that she could understand, both of them, Italian and Hebrew. And so she followed this.
As one does.
Right. So she followed the story from that plaque, discovered the real Red House, and then developed her story from there. So it was an interesting look at kind of a lesser known part of World War II, the Italian Jews and the internment camps set up in Italy for them.
Now, I hadn't heard about this title at all, or your previous title, The Imagined Life. How do you choose kind of the books that you're going to feature on Marginalia?
Well, I receive emails from publicists. Mm-hmm. I usually, you know, I get
but
about
you get a lot of them.
I get about a dozen a day.
Wow. Yeah.
And then Haley is my producer, and we keep a record of any pitch that we've received, and we divide it on a calendar basis, mm-hmm. based on when the book will come out.
Because you like to do an author interview and have it run on the day that
the book
releases.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Is it like
there,
the synopsis speaks to you?
Sometimes we start to read it, mm-hmm. to see. Sometimes, we also have advance access to some audiobooks,
right.
from Penguin Random House, at least. And some of the other publishers will figure out a way to get us advance audio as well. But we might start listening just to see if it captures.
Mm-hmm. Or if you recognize the author, have read the author before.
Yes. Sometimes I've worked with the publicist before and have had really good experiences with that publicist. And so a lot of times I'm trusting, mm-hmm. them when they say, you're not going to want to miss this one.
Yeah.
We also go to those lists of anticipated, mm-hmm. books. Mm-hmm. And so if I've heard about this author or heard about this book, you know, I'll lean toward that one. Andrew Porter, I actually received a personal email from him because he said, I am friends with Christopher Jansma and Kimberly King Parsons.
Oh,
and
wow.
I know you,
yeah.
have talked to them, and I hope you consider my book.
How smart of him.
Because I love both those authors.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was a different exception. Then he, mm-hmm. got me in touch with his publicist, and
yeah.
I did work through her.
But it is difficult because even when I'm trying to think of books to review, obviously there are, you know, ones that I've been waiting on. Mm-hmm. I look at a lot of it has to do with the calendar and release dates. We want to be very, very current. But there are so many books coming out every week, thousands of books every week, and narrowing those down to something that's, you know, going to give our listeners a lot of variety. And it's always, there's always like a real, I get a real kick out of finding a, you know, a debut novel or any kind of book that not a lot of people are talking mm-hmm. about.
And we do try to mix it up with, you know, we don't do a lot of nonfiction, but we do yeah. some. We do not do a lot of kids books, but we do some.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We try to mix up genre a little bit. We did a couple of poetry books at the beginning
yes,
of April.
You did.
Sometimes if I am reading a brief history of seven killings for school, which is 600 plus pages, I might opt to read a 200 page book for the author interview.
Ain't that the case? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So many books, so little time.
Yeah,
it's
so
just not
time.
Enough time. But yeah, that's an interesting insight. I think probably a lot of our listeners are wondering about, like, how do you guys come up with what exactly you're going to read?
And there are so many that I can't get to,
right.
and I feel very sad about it.
Yeah, because it sort of goes into the abyss, because there's
right.
all these new titles coming out every week, and to get to, and but next month I actually am bringing some backlist, because including a nonfiction, so I can't wait to talk about. I'll just sort of tease to it.
Very good.
All right, the last book I'm going to talk about today is one of my favorites of the year, bar none. It is The Road to Tender Hearts by Annie Hartnett. This book. People, gosh, I love it so, so much. I had not read Annie Hartnett before. And why? Because I own both of her previous novels.
Huh.
Something, somewhere along the line, somebody told me that Annie Hartnett was great, and I trusted them and bought her books, but I had not picked them up. Well, then we got an advance audio copy of The Road to Tender Hearts, and my husband and I listened to it on a road trip. We were hooked and smiling and laughing out loud from the word go. It is so wonderful. She is so quirky. Reminds me a lot of Kevin Wilson. This is kind of a dark, tragic comedy. The story of PJ Halliday, a 60-something sort of down on his luck, although he is a lottery winner. Down on his luck guy. Down on his luck.
Ticket.
Yep. Alcoholic guy. Who is reading the obituaries one day and realizes that the guy his high school crush ended up marrying has died. So she's available again. And he wants to go and, you know, just try to win her heart. And she is at a retirement community called Tender Hearts in Arizona. And he is in a little town in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's so much going on in this novel. It's Little Miss Sunshine meets I don't know what. It had like so many, like I said, laugh out loud moments. There's these surprising turns, including a lot of death. There's a cat that can predict when people die that at the very beginning of the novel is in a nursing home. So you can imagine how that works out. These nursing home residents are running from this cat, not wanting to get near it. She has such a wonderful way of taking something really, really tragic. I mean, PJ also is mourning the loss of his daughter who died tragically as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of grief in this novel, a lot of sadness, a lot of loss. And she somehow magically doesn't make it okay or magically wave a wand to make it go away, but these people learn to find joy in each other and to find comfort in each other. And it is, there's so much humanity here, and the story is, you know, and I almost hate to say heartwarming because I don't want you to think it's like a Hallmark movie, because
right.
it very much is not, but it is the best of all worlds. It's dark and funny and surprising, and in the end, I teared up, and I clutched this novel to my chest in a sort of audio way. And that is by like just putting my fist in front of my chest and going, oh my gosh, that was perfect. It ended so perfectly. I loved it. I highly recommend it. It's The Road to Tender Hearts by Annie Hartnett.
So I also read yeah. slash listened to it.
Had a wonderful interview with her,
I love her.
Oh, my gosh.
But what was funny was I was telling Suzanne, I said, I think I have a few minutes left of this book. And she said,
because I had been raving about the last line.
Well, no, you didn't bring up the last line until that moment.
Even just the last words are so good.
And I said, well, you know, they're home. The cat has found Ivy. Ivy's thinking, okay, great. Now I have to keep, you know,
take care of
an, one more thing that PJ has brought into my life. But okay. And then Suzanne looks at me and she's like, well, you're there.
Like, literally said, there.
What? So I bring out my phone and I start playing it. And the narrator narrates the last line.
But there were, to Beth's credit, it did have like 2.5 minutes left in the audio. So she was like, yeah, I've probably got like 10 pages left or so. No, those were the credits. Those are the credits, the acknowledgments. I don't know what was in that 2 minutes, but she was literally like a sentence away from finishing it when she stopped the line.
And it was the best line of the book.
Oh, so perfect. Annie Hartnett, I salute you. My goodness, this was such an enjoyable novel. Unfortunately, I'm reading it early in the year, so, you know, what's going to measure up to it? That's
right.
The joy of reading, though, isn't it, Beth?
That's
something,
right.
Something is going to come along. Last year, speaking real quickly about the Pulitzers, last year we had James, what, in March or April?
It was early. I remember reading it in April.
Yeah, I think it was our Lit Feast book for a spring month anyway. And I remember thinking, whew, good luck anything measuring up to this. Turns out nothing did. It won every award almost it could possibly win, including the Pulitzer.
But do you want to talk about the Pulitzer? Because you sent me a fascinating article from the New York Times.
And also, New York Times did a story about it. And also, Drew Broussard of Lit Hub magazine did a piece on it, which the Times quotes. When the Pulitzers came out, James won the Pulitzer for fiction. And then there were three finalists listed, which means that there were four total finalists, which never happens. And that raised a lot of eyebrows. And Broussard mentions in his piece for Lit Hub that there's sort of an interesting process for the Pulitzer where you've got the Pulitzer jury, the people who sift through these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books to come up with finalists and then a winner. And then you've got the Pulitzer board. And there's a lot of speculation that maybe there was some discontent where either the jury didn't decide on one or decided on one and then the board sort of overruled them and said, no, we'd like to see another finalist. I don't know what happened, but there's something going on there.
It was interesting. I mean, just this morning in our news meeting, Tom Shine was talking about the Pulitzer Awards in journalism and like the year that the Watergate story broke. It won the Pulitzer, but it wasn't even a finalist. They got to the finalists and they said, wait, what about the Watergate story? Oh, it didn't make it. Well, yeah, it made
it
now,
will.
and it's a winner.
It almost sounds like that's what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so seldom, and you know this to be the case too, so seldom is the Pulitzer winner or maybe even any of the finalists, so seldom do they have the commercial success that James did.
Right.
The widespread visibility and awareness of that novel that had.
Yes, not to that level. I mean, last year there were two winners, and I think they were both really, I mean, we knew both of them. You had read both
of
them.
Right, yes.
This year, we had both read James.
And I read Headshot.
And you read Headshot.
And then
the other two, we were like, what?
The other two finalists, by the way, are Mice 1961 by Stacy something. We'll have it in our show notes. And The Unicorn Woman. Neither of those had we ever heard of. And we read and listen to a lot of book stuff.
Right.
So it always surprises me. And last year's winner, Night Watch. We had not really.
Was it Jane Phillips or something?
We had not heard of. Then we did afterward and liked it very much. But yeah, it's very interesting, the politics of that. And I think something will probably come out, you know, like people talk and we'll eventually probably find out what happened there. But I will say, highly recommend Headshot as well by Rita Bullwinkle. And that is going to be our June Literary Feast selection since we wanted to go with a Pulitzer winner or finalist. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be our Lit Feast selection for June. I'm very much looking forward to talking about that. So.
Well, and that's why I brought up the 2012 when Karen Russell was a finalist. There were three finalists that year, Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson, The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, and Swamplandia by Karen Russell. And no prize was given, and they just listed the three finalists.
That's
and the jury,
just,
yeah.
That's bull. I'm sorry. Like, pick something. Come on.
The jury that year, the chair was Susan Larson. She was the former book editor for the Times Picayune and host of The Reading Life at WWNO. Maureen Corrigan, who was part of Fresh Air, right?
She was part of the 2012 jury?
And Michael Cunningham.
Ooh. Wow, the author?
Right.
Oh my goodness, they just couldn't decide. Yeah. I think that's really a cop-out, though. I mean, I just give us a winner. Come on. That was like, oh, what?
Yeah, and I think I misspoke when I said last year, I mentioned
year
Demon
before
Cop.
Last,
yeah, that was 2023. Night Watch was 2024.
And
so
2023 was Trust and Demon Copperhead. Both
right.
Excellent, very different novels, but both excellent. Yeah, I want to go back and read Swamplandia because obviously it should have won the Pulitzer.
Yeah, clearly.
Something should have.
Clearly.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to stop.
Okay.
All right. Until next time.
Keep turning those pages.
Bye, Beth.
Bye.
Books and Whatnot is a production of KMUW Wichita. Our team of engineers, producers, editors, and hosts are Mark Statzer, Torin Anderson, Haley Krausen, Jonathan Huber, Luann Stevens, Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Suzanne Perez. You can reach us by email sent to podcasts@kmuw.org, on Twitter @booksandwhatnot, and on Instagram, books_and_whatnot. Find more conversations and a list of books discussed in this episode at kmuw.org.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.